KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, physicist and MacArthur Genius Award recipient Richard Muller teaches what appears to be the most popular class at UC Berkeley, and he's turned the course into a book called Physics for Future Presidents. What do future presidents, and for that matter, you the public, need to know about the physics behind terrorist threats, energy, nuclear power, space travel, and global warming? Richard Muller joins us for the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Richard Muller is professor of physics at University of California, Berkeley, and a past winner of the MacArthur Fellowship, the often called Genius Award. He has served as a government advisor and has been featured on many PBS and BBC documentaries. He also taught a course, which he continues to teach, that's often highlighted in a poll that was taken by the Daily Californian over at UC Berkeley as the best course on the UC Berkeley campus. Focuses on physics for non-science students, and that course has been crystallized, a good physics word, into a book called Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. Professor Muller joins us for this forum hour. Good to have you here.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Well, let me begin with the underlying premise here. It's not only world leaders and presidents that you're after here. It's all of us, the lay public and those of us who grapple with and try to understand physics and want to understand these issues, particularly in terms of comprehensible ways. But, for example, with the President of the United States, someone could say, well, they've got scientific advisors. Why do they need to understand physics at all?
I take the example of one of my students who came to me a year after she had taken the course, all excited because they had dinner with a physicist who was working on controlled thermonuclear fusion. And he told the family about what he was doing, how this would change everything. And they sat and listened, and it sounded like some degree of awe. And then at the end, there was silence. What can you say? So my student piped up, solar power is something I'm very excited about. And the physicist, she said he laughed and said, if you want enough solar power just for the state of California, you'd have to plaster the whole state with solar cells. Now, she said, no, your numbers aren't right. There's a gigawatt of power in a square kilometer. That's not much bigger than a nuclear power plant. It puts out the same energy. And she said he was silent. And he thought for a few moments and said, well, there's some efficiency factors here, but your numbers sound about right. I'm going to have to look at that again. So what I think we need is a president who knows enough about the subject that he can tell when his science advisor isn't perhaps giving him the whole story.
Well, in fact, I hope presidents do read your book. I think there's a lot to learn in it, a lot about energy, a lot also about nuclear energy and nuclear weaponry and terrorism and what weapons terrorists might use, as well as these are all the categories that are covered in the book, space and space satellites and global warming. So let's look at some of the things that you actually take on here and bring into focus for us. I guess a good place to begin maybe would be with a nuclear bomb. And the important fact, again, that might be presented at a dinner table conversation, that say a dozen of those shoe bombs that we associate with Richard Reed would be much more dangerous, in your judgment.
Well, I think that's the case. Nuclear weapons are very hard to make, as was demonstrated, I think, by the recent North Korean nuclear test. They exploded a plutonium bomb, but by every measurement, it was a fizzle. It released less energy than the terrorists did when they crashed into the World Trade Center, a factor of three less. Whereas the weapon that you can buy at your corner oil station is fearsome. It's what was used in the World Trade Center. The energy released from gasoline when it burns is 15 times greater than the energy of TNT. And it's been effectively used. I think the shoe bomb, again, from my work with terrorists, I don't claim to be an expert, but I have spent quite a bit of time working with the Defense Department trying to do, try to look at what can be done, counterterrorism. I have the sense that they were successful with airplanes in the past. They were successful using gasoline in the past. That's the most likely thing for them to try to use again. That's what concerns me the most.
Yeah, at one point you say it's almost impossible to think like a terrorist, but given the thought of maybe setting off a nuclear bomb or going back to the kind of pattern that they began with 9/11, they're more likely at least to go back as you see it. You use the word fizzle about North Korea. You also use the word in the book fizzle about anthrax, just to move over to biological weaponry for a moment. Anthrax is fizzle because...
If after the anthrax attack, a friend of mine found a website, looked quickly to see what he could find out about anthrax, and on September 1st, the Canadian Defense Ministry had posted the results of an experiment with anthrax, in which a gram of anthrax had been delivered in a letter to a test facility. What was dead anthrax? It was a simulant. They opened it up and then measured how much it would spread. And their conclusion was that in a facility, in an ordinary office building, spreading anthrax in a letter would kill hundreds, perhaps thousands of people. If you look at the literature about anthrax prior to the actual anthrax attack, it was full of how dangerous it is and how many thousands of people it would kill. So I suspect that the anthrax attack was the second wave and that it too didn't work. The number of lethal doses delivered to Senator Patrick Leahy can be measured as hundreds of thousands to millions, but no one died from that envelope. So fortunately, the Canadian experiment, which, of course, the terrorists would have had access to, was not a good representative of what really happens.
You also mention at one point you talk about Jose Padilla and the idea of a dirty bomb, and you say natural gas and blowing up apartment buildings would yield more dead, and... Your assumption is, again, that perhaps Padilla was called off of his idea because, well, it wasn't as good or as effective as far as...
Well, according to the deposition at his trial, Al-Qaeda instructed him to switch from a dirty bomb to this more practical using fossil fuels as a weapon. I suspect, I mean, in my own judgment, that was a wise thing to do, wise in the sense of if you want to spread terror. The dirty bomb is really hard to do. If you gather together enough radioactivity to really do some damage, you're very likely to kill yourself in the process. Once you spread it out, you drop below the threshold where people die. They still have some small induced possibility of cancer, but not very many dead bodies. And my reading of terrorists is that they want dead bodies on the scene in the news, not simply... everybody now, instead of a 20% chance of dying from cancer from natural causes, has a 20.01% chance. I don't think that would meet their goals.
Well, you're pretty also declarative about the idea that radiation, although people are very afraid of it, probably is the best thing for cancer cells, which, I mean, in terms of doing the work on them that needs to be done, whereas a lot of people feel avoid it.
It's really a tragedy when someone who has cancer doesn't want radiation treatment because they're afraid of radiation. Radiation has been like a witch, or you might think of it as, think back to the fear of communists, the lurking evil within our society. People are so afraid of radioactivity that they act irrationally. And I would like to see our president explain in a clear way that this radioactivity is not as dangerous as people think, just like fire. Fire is dangerous, but we have it in our kitchens.
You have to have it explained by a president who's going to have credibility, though, don't you?
Well, I think
there's a lot of skepticism about that.
The president needs to explain it in a nonpartisan way, not say anything controversial, but simply explain the physics facts. I think that physics can be explained in this way. I'm rather proud of the fact, for example, that my students don't know what my politics are.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with Richard Muller. He's professor of physics at UC Berkeley. He's put out a book called Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. I'm going to read something from your book. Because nukes are badly misunderstood by the public, you will have a tough job convincing people to support your policies. This is to the president, of course, no matter what they are. Many people think all radioactivity is bad, and they fear any clicks that they hear on a Geiger counter. If you argue that the waste from a nuclear reactor can be safely stored for long enough, many people will regard you as a dupe of the nuclear industry. You may try to present the numbers only to discover that nobody wants to listen. You're really moving upstream on that one, aren't you?
I know the physics, but the politics is up to the president.
Now, can a politician, I mean, even the most credible politician, say you've got nothing to fear or you've got minimal fear when it comes to nuclear waste?
Well, on the nuclear waste issue, there is a case where I think scientists do as much harm as some of the anti-nuclear activists. We're always looking for ingenious new ways to solve the problem. I think one can present the issue in a, again, nonpartisan, technical way and illustrate that that the waste problem is, I believe, technically solved. In the past, past presidents didn't want to confront this because, after all, we had this cheap, clean alternative, fossil fuels. Now that we know that fossil fuels are not clean and they're no longer cheap, we can't just dismiss nuclear as something that, let's just avoid it and not raise this issue. In fact, it is probably cleaner and cheaper than the alternatives at this point.
In fact, you make a case for it in some ways. You say if you're concerned about carcinogens released into the environment, coal is much worse.
Yeah, and that's true. Coal ash is often just buried underground and water leaks into it.
What about future presidents looking at, say, Iran with centrifuges or Syria with the refining abilities? You know, the notion is, boy, that's just one step away from being able to deliver some kind of nuclear weapon in many people's minds.
Well, I think that's right. That's real fear. There are two types of nuclear weapons, as I describe in the book, that a rogue state might develop. The first ones they would develop would be either uranium or plutonium, and they're very different. The bomb that North Korea tried was plutonium. It's actually very hard to make a bomb that can work. It's relatively easy to separate out the plutonium you need from a nuclear reactor once you deny inspections. But once you have that, it's very hard to do because of contaminants in the plutonium. Uranium bombs are much easier. When we made a uranium bomb in World War II, it was the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. That bomb had never been tested. The problem there is separating the uranium, and that's what Saddam was doing in Iraq. That's what the centrifuges are being used for in Iran. That's a real concern.
It's also a concern of many people just the transportation of plutonium, I mean, moving it around and so forth. Do you have those concerns? And they should be the concerns of future presidents?
Well, I'm less concerned than most people. People worry about the so-called plutonium economy. And once plutonium is a commodity, that people can divert it for use in nuclear weapons. The way the U.S. has handled this in the past is we don't separate it from the fuel. We just leave it in with the waste fuel and where it's really inaccessible. Even if you do separate it, it's not easy to make a bomb out of it. So I think I am less concerned about the plutonium economy than most people.
Talking to Richard Muller, Physics for Future Presidents is the title of his book, The Science Behind the Headlines. And you say we'll never run out of oil.
Well, not never, but at the current prices, a great deal of oil that was once considered unrecoverable is now recoverable. The oil sands of Canada are a great example. We have an enormous amount of coal in the United States, and coal can be converted to oil. In the past, it was just too expensive. It's been done in Germany during World War II when they had coal but no oil, so they converted it. They invented the process to do that. It was done in South Africa when, under apartheid, countries would not export oil to South Africa. So they started doing this too, and they're one of the leaders in doing this now. Estimates that I get from the industry is that you can produce oil at about $50 to $65 a barrel. That's one-third to one-half the price we're paying now. So I believe the oil bubble will burst because you can make it cheaper than the current prices. The problem is that instability in oil prices make people afraid to put money into this. If the price of oil were to drop back to 50, these plants would go bankrupt. That happened once before under the Carter administration when alternative energy was being pushed, and then the price of oil and natural gas crashed, and they were left holding these big factories that were not worth anything.
So what about ethanol?
Well, ethanol is a very good stopgap measure. I think we're beginning to see now the downside that had been unanticipated. Corn ethanol doesn't make sense. Everybody agrees corn ethanol doesn't make sense. The cynical way of saying it, I think, is true, that corn ethanol has been important because of the early caucuses in Iowa. But you don't gain much. Ethanol from sugarcane, ethanol from some of the grasses that can grow, miscanthus, for example, is a good idea. But now we're beginning to see the impact that this has on food around the world. So we're seeing a downside to that that we hadn't anticipated.
Now, you say in the book that there's probably little chance for electric cars, which some people are going to find not necessarily swallowable. So you're advising a future president. What about cars to fit a future president in terms of the American population? Fuel cell or hybrids or hydrogen or...
Well, I think the hybrid is a proven technology. I've been teaching about hybrids for the last 15 years. It was a coming technology. There are many other things that can be done. We can make engines more efficient. We can make the car lighter. There's a lot of misinformation there about lighter cars being more dangerous. This is another thing the president has to straighten out. So as anybody who's taken elementary physics knows, the first thing you learn...
Excuse me, a lot of misinformation about lighter cars being more dangerous?
Yes, yes. People think lighter cars are more dangerous, and they don't have to be. They can be if they're cheap and not well-made, but some studies done at UC Berkeley have shown that lighter cars really can be as safe as the heavier cars. They often are more safe. As for energy efficiency, I think... One of the main complaints I have about the government for the past 20 years has been the fact that we do not mandate more fuel-efficient cars. This is important not just for CO2 emissions, but also for energy independence.
Now, you talk about space, too, and you have some actually strong recommendations about space. I mean, one of them is not to have manned spacecraft.
Most scientists would love to go into space without a human along. You put a human in there and you have a safety certification that drives the price way up. If your instrument fails, you can have a human fix it. But if it's not human qualified, for the money you've saved, you can send up another satellite. NASA has believed or acted as if to have a continuing program, we must put humans in space because that's what excites the public imagination. They justify this in part by bringing along science. But really, we could do most of the really best science of the last 40 years was done with unmanned robots. It's glorious that humans can build robots that can do such fantastic things. And I think any future president needs to ask really hard when something is being put on a space shuttle or other manned craft, do we really benefit? Is it better done by having humans along? The political case is without humans, people will not support it. The U.S. people will not do it. I don't think that's right. I think people glory in the wonderful science that's come out of space.
Well, those Mars landers had pretty phenomenal success. I'm talking about Spirit and Opportunity.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. The space telescope, my students, when they have photos on their walls, it's taken with the space telescope. People say that you need an astronaut to be able to fix the space telescope. But in fact, we've had large telescopes in space done for spying missions for a long time. Those haven't been fixed by humans. If one goes bad, send up another.
Talking again with Richard Muller, who is professor of physics at Berkeley and teaches a course in physics for non-science majors, non-science students, most voted the best course, in fact, at UC Berkeley's campus. Let's talk about future presidents and global warming, and particularly what they can control and what they can't control. Should they watch Al Gore's film, first of all?
Well, Al Gore's film is a moving, inspiring film that gets people into action. A lot of my colleagues recognize that most of what he says is exaggerated or misleading, but they support the film anyway.
Most of your physics colleagues.
Most of my physics colleagues, right. But they think the film is doing some good. Al Gore, because he is a politician, can say things that we professors are not supposed to say. For example, I think one of the problems with the film is that it cherry picks. He look at all the various things that have happened in weather in the past 10 years, pick the bad ones, and then attribute them to global warming. That's also the good thing in the film, because it scares people. My feeling is that I'm not a politician, so I don't know the best way to get people into action. I think the president needs to know the whole truth, not the truth with spin on it. So that's what I try to do in my book.
What would a president need to know about global warming, perhaps, especially in the long term?
Well, a couple things. One is that Al Gore is absolutely right when he says there is a consensus on global warming. Now, I don't agree with the consensus 100%. There's some places where I think it's wrong. But I'm willing to teach the consensus and just state where I disagree. In An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore correctly states there is a consensus, but then he starts giving his own opinion, which is far removed from what the consensus says. Here's what the consensus says. I can give you the quote, but it says that there is a 90% chance that humans have been responsible for some of the global warming of the past 50 years. That if you look at this now and see how much is attributed to the United States, we as a country have contributed more than any other country. The total rise has been about 1 degree Fahrenheit. That surprises a lot of people. They say, I see global warming all around them. What about the wildfires in the Bay Area? What about Hurricane Katrina? What about these data on tornadoes increasing? Well, the tornadoes were not increasing, they were decreasing. Hurricane Katrina is not an effect of global warming. This is cherry picking, and if you look at Hurricane Katrina, for example, it was not a particularly violent storm when it hit New Orleans. It's just that New Orleans was a very fragile place.
So you're saying the sky is not falling then?
Well, there are scientists who say the sky is falling. They say we're at a tipping point. I simply think the public should know that that's not the consensus. The consensus is that, and this is the IPCC report. If you need to know those letters. It's like talking about world affairs without knowing the letters UN. The IPCC shared the Nobel Prize with Al Gore. What isn't stated is that there are vast differences between what Al Gore says and what the IPCC says. The United States has been responsible so far for 0.2, one-fifth of a degree Fahrenheit of warming. That's our contribution. That's terrible. It's more than anybody else's. The fear is how much will we contribute in the future? According to the projections, if we stay the track and don't take Al Gore's change our fossil fuel economy, if we just stay the track we're on now, we will contribute another one-fifth of a degree Fahrenheit. What we worry about is a global warming of 4, 5, 8 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a real danger, but it's not going to come from the U.S. It will come from China, India, and Russia.
We should mention that the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We're talking to Richard A. Mueller. His book is Physics for Future Presidents, the Science Behind the Headlines. You learn a lot from this book. You learn that, an unmanned solar-powered spy plane is harder for an enemy military to detect and evade than a spy satellite. And recycling programs are unlikely to have any significant effect on atmospheric carbon dioxide. You can actually make a bigger difference by simply replacing tungsten light bulbs with fluorescent ones. All kinds of facts to face in the world of physics and find out why. And indeed, let me open up the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, is open to you, and please join us whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email simply to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest is Richard Mueller, professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley, also former winner of a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award, also a National Science Foundation Alan T. Waterman Award for original research, and he teaches a course, a renowned course for non-science students, Physics 10, Physics for Future Presidents. It attracts about 1,000 students a year and has lured many online students in at least 35 states, 43 countries, and moving up. I think last count we're what?
83 countries. 48 states.
Yeah. Actually, I should give out the YouTube address here. It's http://tinyurl.com, tinyurl as in URL, /4UV6. That's the number 4, Y-O-U-V, and the number 6. And we're going to go right to our callers here. Let's begin with Roland from Palo Alto. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael and Professor. I wanted to put in a slight footnote on the dirty bomb evaluation, and that is that we saw a very strong example of selecting a radioactive material to kill somebody in a manner which did not in any way damage the perpetrators, specifically the assassination of the Russian exile in London, using an alpha-emitting radioactive material, polonium-210, which can be handled very safely if it's in a container, but once it's released in microscopic quantities can be very lethal because of its short half-life and its metabolism in the body. So I don't think we can dismiss the possibility of that kind of an activity in the future.
Professor Muller.
Well, you're referring to Litvinenko, who was assassinated in this way. After that assassination, there was a lot of talk about how polonium-210 is very rare and you can only get it if you have a major facility. So I ordered some on the web and I brought it into my class to show people. And it's in dusting brushes used for the old-fashioned kind of photography, which many of the listeners may not have heard of when you use film.
That's kind of scary. Many people thought it came right from Putin personally.
Right. Well, I think it's important to know that this stuff is commercially available. In this case, I'm not worried about radioactive assassination. It would have been far easier to do with arsenic or Botox. Botox is one of the most dangerous materials known to man. I think it was chosen to make a point. They chose this because they wanted it to get to the newspapers. They wanted it to sound exotic. They wanted it to sound like nothing that had ever been done before. If they had simply assassinated him with a bullet, it would not have been so dramatic or in the presses. He would die over a period of a week. But
you also saw his face turning into this monstrous kind of beastly countenance,
yeah.
Which I think also, probably from that perspective that you're saying, was good PR.
It was good PR. I think it was done for PR. I don't regard polonium-210 as dangerous compared to other poisons, for example.
Let me thank the caller. We'll move along to more of your calls for our guest, Richard Muller, and we'll go to Jason. Morning, Jason.
Good morning. I'd like to make a comment regarding the assertion that we have kind of all the oil we'll ever need and we can get as much oil as we want from coal. Right now, we use about 85 million barrels of oil per day. And my comment is that we can't get 85 million barrels of oil per day from coal. We just can't produce it that much. So rather than just saying how much do we have, I think an important question is how quickly can we actually extract that oil? So it's the first derivative, if you like. The other comment I would like to make is that there's a certain efficiency to how we can extract oil and or create fuels. And the efficiency is very high for drilling for oil. But for tar sands or maybe making oil from coal, the efficiency is very low. It takes a lot of energy to make that gallon of gas. So I think just saying we have a lot of fossil fuels so we don't need to worry about the problem is pretty false.
Well, I agree completely. Thank you for clarifying all that. I think you'll find much of that in my book. Yes, we don't have the facilities to do that. In fact, when Barack Obama was a sponsor of a bill to do this, he got into a lot of trouble with environmentalists because the biggest problem in this is that coal does produce carbon dioxide. And unless it's sequestered, then it adds to the global warming problem. As for not having the facilities, absolutely right. We have to build the facilities. There were two companies that recently put forth all they wanted from the U.S. government was a guarantee that they could sell their oil at $60 a barrel if the price ever dropped lower. And they were denied this kind of a guarantee, I think primarily because people were worried about the carbon dioxide that would come and the idea of building a infrastructure that will take advantage of our coal scares a lot of people who are worried about the carbon dioxide. So that infrastructure does not exist here. It would be very expensive to build. But eventually, if we decide that carbon dioxide is not a problem, something I'm very skeptical will ever happen, then we can build this infrastructure. It's not going to help us in the next 10 years. It takes a long time to do this. But eventually, the amount of fossil fuels we have is enormous. And although it costs energy to do it, as you say, you do gain a net energy, certainly better than you get from corn ethanol.
So you acknowledge that we're probably going to continue to have some dependency on fossil fuel, despite the need to at least have some balance where alternative fuels are concerned. excuse me, you've got Senators Obama and McCain right in the room with us here. What do you tell them about drilling?
The real problem is not the United States. The real problem is China, India, Russia. Odd to include Russia as a developing country these days, but that's the case. If any program, any suggestion that does not that is not usable in China is not addressing the issue. They surpassed the United States last year. They have every right to do this. Their standard of living is still way below ours. And they're going to continue expanding, and they're going to dominate the emissions. If you suggest a program for the cutting of U.S. emissions, you have to recognize this is a feel-good measure that you hope will work by setting an example. But I'm very dubious about whether China will slow down its growth because the U.S., after reaching an enormously high standard of living, then cuts back.
Yeah, no, I'm quite in agreement with you on that. In fact, we've talked a lot about developing nations and how they look to us and say, well, you've been using these resources for so long, now it's our turn, and we want to move forward economically. But what I'm asking is it good physics in terms of getting the kind of oil that we need or even exporting it, which certainly would be the case in many instances, and going into a place like Anwar and just drilling for oil? Any thoughts on that?
Well, Anwar is getting kind of low on oil these days. They have a lot of natural gas, and I think some of what's going on at Anwar is a hope that they can now exploit that natural gas. There's offshore California, which is in the newspaper headlines today. There's a lot of oil there that hasn't been exploited. The big thing that's happening, of course, is the Canadian oil sands, where now that the price of oil is so high, previously those were not listed as recoverable oil, but now they are because the price has gone up.
And we're supposed to get oil out of, or at least petroleum out of shale at one point.
Well, we have enormous shale reserves, enough to last us not just hundreds of years, but maybe 1,000 years, assuming the environmental problems are not going to kill that. But that's more expensive than these other processes. That's more expensive than coal to oil, for example. Much considerably more expensive than the Canadian oil sands. So I think that's in the distant future. It's not something to be exploiting right away.
Raul, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for having this conversation. I wish the conversation had a little bit more balance from somebody who might have an informed point of view that is contrary to your guest. I consider the burning of fossil fuels the equivalent of heating your house with a charcoal grill. We're dying out here, and I think the planet doesn't need better ways of turning coal or shale or any of those things into burnable fuel. I think solar and wind power and geothermal are really the way the future is going to look like if we are to have a future. I know your guest is a physicist, but he seems to be also an expert on economics. He's also an expert on many other subjects that I don't really have time to list. So anyway, I really feel that this focus on how we can stretch the oil, convert things into burnable fuels is a misguided effort, and I wish physicists and other people like him would focus on the clean technologies that are possible, and maybe will actually happen with their help. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that statement. Response from you, Professor Muller?
Touché. I am not an economist. You're absolutely right. However, when you say the opposite point of view, I just want to inform you of what I consider the problem to be. The problem is that coal is dirt cheap. The problem is that China has built 70 new coal plants in the last year, and they're continuing at this rate. This is, in my opinion, a looming disaster. How we handle this, I'm letting you know the problem is there because coal and fossil fuels are abundant. We're not about to run out of them, and that makes the problem much more difficult than you might otherwise think. I'm a great supporter, and as you'll see in my book, the most important thing we can do is energy conservation. That comes way before anything else. Clean coal is, in principle, possible for electricity. We can do this by sequestering the carbon dioxide at the plant. Solar is coming along very quickly, but it's still quite expensive. There's real hope it will come down in price. And wind is explosive, and we're now building wind plants as fast as General Electric can make the wind turbines. So I'm in favor of all those things, but I think the economists, the real economists, the president has to know the facts that determine where the economics is going to go.
Let me go to some of our emails. Romolo says, I was going to purchase a hybrid, but then I heard that the lithium battery could be harmful because of radiation. Is this true?
No, there's no radiation in the lithium battery. The problem with a hybrid is that it's expensive, and the lithium battery is expensive. So in my Prius, for example, I could get, by driving it carefully, 51 miles per gallon. I've done that repeatedly. I'm not really saving money because the car is expensive, and these lithium-ion batteries are expensive to replace. A one-pound computer battery in that you buy for your computer costs over $100. The batteries eventually have to be replaced. Current batteries can only be recharged 500 to 1,000 times. Make sure you fold that in. If you're thinking about buying a battery car, make sure you fold that in.
Let me go to a few more emails here. This is from Richard, who says, Professor Mueller said we can store nuclear waste for long enough. What does he think is long enough?
When the radioactivity gets down to the level of the natural uranium in the ground, then I think that's long enough. So let me give you some numbers here. The old numbers were there's some plutonium in that, and it'll take 10,000, 20,000 years before that plutonium is down to the level of the radioactivity in the uranium that was originally removed. But most of the radioactivity is short-lived. And here's a figure I give in the book. If we could store it that way safely for 100 years, then the radioactivity is 100 times more radioactive than the original uranium. At that point, if you could simply store it with a 10% chance that 10% will leak, you're back where you started.
Oh, we've got a caller on point here from up in Healdsburg. Daniel, join us. Good morning.
Yeah, I had a comment and a question. I think you're totally wrong when it comes to nuclear power, sir. I think it borders on propaganda. Right now, the French are in their waste dumps for nuclear energy are to their max. And in fact, they have extreme leakage going into the Champagne region where they make the famous wine and champagnes. Also, the German government has put a stop to making more nuclear power plants and are going in the opposite direction, closer to doing coal hybrid plants. So, and then when you explain what to do with the low-level waste, it borders on insanity. Who is going to watch that low-level waste for, what, 100 years, 1,000 years? It really, really is irresponsible. But my next question to you is, what of the two candidates have you personally been advising to build nuclear plants? And before you answer that, we know Obama doesn't want to talk about it, but he supports building nuclear plants. And John McCain comes straight out and says he wants to build 100 nuclear power plants. Now, what are we going to do with high-level waste and even more so, low-level waste? And I am just appalled that you're out propagandizing how safe it is. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. I think there's some serious tell us how you really feel. Go ahead.
Al Gore, in his movie, makes a big point of the fact that the trouble with most people isn't their ignorance. It's knowing so many things that ain't so. And I think this is unfortunately an example that I try to straighten out in my book. Again, I have not been advising either one of them. I think what's happening is that the scientific community and the people who have really studied the subject are beginning to realize that although nuclear is dangerous, it's not as dangerous as fossil fuel. Although it's dangerous, there are serious problems with windmills, and China and India simply can't afford them, that the waste storage problem is not what our caller thinks it is. And I think if he reads my book, he might change his mind because I really work very hard not to put spin on these things. I'm letting you know what the physics is, what numbers. I don't care whether what side you're on. I'm happy to discuss the numbers.
What is dangerous about a windmill?
Well, give an example. A wind farm off the coast of Massachusetts has been under attack by the environmentalists for sound that affects the animals, for the ugliness, for what it might do to the environment. Birds get killed. Oh, well, they are dangerous because they're dangerous to the people who have to maintain them. I'm a real believer in windmills. I think windmills in the near future should be expanded as much as possible. Some of the new windmills are twice the height of the Statue of Liberty. These are being done in Germany, which is on the forefront of developing windmills, and they produce 8 megawatts. It's a wonderful technology. We have to expand it. We still don't know all the environmental consequences of disturbing the wind pattern on the surface of the Earth. And I'll bet you that after these wind farms go up, there'll be lots of lawsuits from people who said they changed the local climate.
Well, since that last caller brought up what he thought were your politics, this is Sarah who says, if on the basis of his ideas about energy and the like, Richard Mueller's students have no idea what his politics are, it is only because they are young and not politically sophisticated. Mueller's physics are in no way politically neutral. If you don't believe me, ask other physicists if they are with him. Here's another listener, Carmine, who says, the temperature of the Earth could be producing electricity and pure hydrogen with zero fuel costs. Why not?
The temperature of the Earth?
So this caller's advancing. Says the temperature of the Earth could be producing electricity and pure hydrogen without zero fuel cost. Why not? I'm not sure I understand.
There is no hydrogen, free hydrogen. The only way we get hydrogen is by either taking it off hydrocarbons, which is what we do these days, or by electrolyzing water. That takes energy. Getting energy from a warm Earth would work if we had a temperature difference. One of the things we talk about in my class, which is not in this book, I don't think the future presidents need to know this as urgently, is that to extract energy from heat, you need a temperature difference. So a warm Earth, if you had a way of dumping that warmth into space, you could do it. But I'm afraid I don't know what the caller is asking.
Read Jeremy Rifkin's book on hydrogen because it really goes into how hydrogen is accessible. Makes it clear, but I'm not sure what he's referring to there either. Here's a listener who says, the Penn and Teller show made the argument that recycling uses more energy than simply throwing the materials away, rendering it counterproductive. Is this true? Is there any worry of running out of landfill space?
I don't know about landfill space. I saw that show, and I really enjoy Penn and Teller. And much of what they say is true. For recycling, there's a humorous point in my book, which is that, for example, if you buy my book, you're actually doing some good for the environment, as long as you keep it for a long time, because it took plants to do that. They removed carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and as long as you don't burn the book, it stays in the book. You're sequestering carbon dioxide in the book.
Milford, Connecticut, Jerry.
Yes,
you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, how you doing today?
Hi there.
I got a question about hybrid cars. There's a lot of hybrid cars, fuel cell, battery, gas, diesel, all generating carbon monoxide and stuff. What about a hybrid car that had, instead of batteries, or instead of a lot of batteries, perhaps capacitors to store the immediate use of electricity, and a small engine that could be run off of any number of fuels? They could run a generator. The generator generates enough electricity to run the DC-powered motors that drive the car. And if you needed immediate power, you could go to the capacitors.
It's starting to sound like Bill Wattenberg's show or something.
Well, I think he's on the right track there. I think this idea of having... Right now we have batteries and we have an electric... We have a gasoline motor in my Prius. The Chevrolet Volt is going to a better system in which the motor is used simply to recharge the battery. But there's a problem in drawing large currents when you need them for acceleration from a battery. And so having a triple hybrid system with something like a capacitor, I would think perhaps two different kinds of batteries, one for quick drainage, one for slow storage, might be somewhat better than the call-in said. But I think this increasing the complexity through ideas such as that for future hybrids is actually a very good idea.
Jerry, thank you for the call, and Let's go to Harvey in Berkeley. Morning.
Hi, Michael and Richard. Thanks for the show. In California, it's all about the water, and it turns out that the four hydroelectric types of plants, that's coal-fired, natural gas, nuclear, and oil-fired, use 136 billion gallons of water daily in the production of electricity. Only agriculture uses more water. Well, here in California this morning, I heard that the lettuce growers in Central Valley they don't have enough water, and they're going to start attacking the Fishermen's Association because they want fish for the lakes and all that.
So Harvey, listen to us online. We did a whole hour on water just yesterday.
And the thing is that solar electric roof shingles and solar panels use no water in the production of electricity. And as a matter of fact, they make no noise, cause no chemical reaction. They work on average they're guaranteed on average for about 25 years. And I think that when one factors in the true cost of creating electricity, that solar electric roof shingles and panels are the least expensive ways. And recently in Southern California, Southern California Edison took 100 commercial buildings, and they're going to cover the rooftops of 100 commercial buildings, and they say that's going to be enough to power 160,000 homes. And that's just 100 rooftops of commercial buildings.
Harvey, let me cut to the chase here, because you're talking about solar being less expensive than our guest is certainly presented as being, and that most people present as being, in terms of the long term. And you say what on that, Richard Mullen?
Well, I don't think his numbers are completely wrong. If in fact they are guaranteed for 25 years, then I think it does make sense, and it does have that advantage. So you want to make sure your company can really fulfill that guarantee. If they guarantee it for 10 years, then you're losing money on the process. So these numbers are all reasonable. You really want to know what Consumer Reports says on it. I'm an enthusiast for solar, and there are some new developments in cheap solar panels that I think put us on the threshold of using this. There are also solar power plants that are under development. So I think solar has a great future. Right now, it's more expensive than coal. It's probably cheaper than natural gas.
Thank you, Harvey. Paul from Mill Valley writes, I've been reading a lot about peak oil lately and have researched that at least three of the big oil producers all pumped less oil this quarter than the previous quarter, which would seem to support that theory. I would think the oil companies would be pumping at max capacity given the current price per barrel. Wanted to know where your guess falls in regards to peak oil, fact or fiction?
Well, we have passed peak oil in the United States for the kind of facilities that we have already made. In the past, if it was going to cost more than $20 or $30 a barrel to drill it, we simply didn't build the oil wells. So we're past that peak. But if the price of oil is going to stay up at over $100 a barrel, then there are many other places that we can drill, and we're not past that peak yet. So where the peak occurs depends on the price of oil. And big issue here is where will it be when you finally have the oil well running? If you have to explore, take the chance, build the facilities, and by that time the prices come back down, then you don't want to do that. So the volatility of the oil price is a major inhibitor. I think we are near peak capacity right now for the facilities that we have. And the worldwide, it's 3%. It's only a 3% margin of extra that could be drilled at the present time.
Chuck, let's hear from you. Thanks for waiting. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks a lot. First, I think the caller was talking about lithium batteries, might have been worried about electromagnetic fields in electric cars. And I was wondering about what's holding back the development of fuel cell cars. Is it practicable to produce, and I think the other caller was probably talking about producing hydrogen by hydrolysis driven by geothermal. But I also had a criticism that when you make precise predictions about fractional degrees of warming in a specific number of years, I wonder if you aren't if a complex, chaotic system like the climate really lends itself to that sort of precise prediction, and if it isn't a bit misleading to make those sort of, we're responsible for, in X number of years, we'll raise the temperature by point whatever degrees.
Well, those weren't my predictions. I'm telling you what the consensus says, what the Nobel Prize-winning IPCC says, what most scientists come up with when they do their back-of-the-envelope calculations, when they do their more sophisticated calculations, and finally when they run it through the computer to check those calculations, those are the consensus. Now, there are scientists who say it's much, much worse, and there are scientists who say it's not nearly so bad. A cloud cover will solve the problem. And I have my own opinion, which I haven't stated on this program. I think it's worthwhile to know what the consensus is. On some of your other issues, I think what's happened to fuel cell cars is the recognition that if you're going to use the best fuel, for example, hydrogen, hydrogen is touted as having much more energy per pound, which it does. It has 2.3 times as much as gasoline, 2.6. On the other hand, hydrogen, you can't get very many pounds in a gallon of gas. And as a result, for the same kind of gas tank, you get one quarter as much energy. And that's if you use liquid hydrogen. If you use gaseous hydrogen, you get 1/40 as much energy. So there are some really serious problems with fuel cells. Battery technology is developing very rapidly, so people are actually more optimistic about batteries than they used to be. And there are some new developments that might make batteries work in the United States. But these batteries are way too expensive for China.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to wrap. But I want to remind listeners that Professor Richard Muller's book is called Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. And he teaches, of course, was voted the best course at UC Berkeley. Get some tips for you on pedagogy maybe next time you're here and how you do what you do. I'm delighted to have had you, though. Thank you so much for being
here. Thank you very much.
And we are with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to remind you, you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or give any suggestions to us of what you'd like to hear by simply emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in response line. And that number is 415-553-3300. I want to thank Senior Editor Dan Zoll and producers Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.